Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Before we dive into the episode, another quick reminder that if you're listening to The Realignment on Apple Podcasts, we would love it if you would scroll to the bottom of the podcast page and rate and review us 5 stars. It really bumps us up in the algorithm and helps people find the show. You guys totally crushed it last week, and we blew past our goal of getting 300 reviews. We could definitely get it to 400 this week. Moving into the show, anyone who listens to The Realignment can tell that Sagar and I definitely have a point of view on the issues we discuss.
One of those issues is the concept of industrial policy, which is broadly defined as a national effort to identify and support growth targeted in industries, right? But industrial policies is seen by supporters as a response to the decline of manufacturing capacity in the United States, increasing and focused competition on China through initiatives that they have launched, like Made in China 2025 program, which explicitly seeks to challenge the U.S. in high-value sector, things like aircraft, semiconductor production. So all that being said, we think it's very great value, right, in challenging one's assumptions and engaging in good faith with thinkers who hold different points of view. So this week, we are bringing on the Hudson Senior Fellow, Thomas Duesterberg, onto the podcast. He's going to expand on a recent Wall Street Journal op-ed where he made the case against industrial policy.
And you're going to see a lot of disagreement during the episode, but the part that I was actually most interested in were the points of commonality across this band of industrial policy support to opposition. So, for example, Duesterberg opposed China's ascension to the World Trade Organization in 2000. So that's an interesting example of how a lot of the time we spent this show focusing on how that was a mistake. He agrees that was a mistake, yet we're diverging in the present day. And then the broad thing that we also agree on is this idea that COVID-19 has demonstrated the need to prioritize the production of medical supplies and other vital products such as semiconductors in the U.S. It's a really great conversation. You guys are really going to enjoy it. Let's dive in. Tom Duesterberg, welcome to The Realignment.
It's a pleasure to be with you guys today.
Good to see you, Tom.
So this entire season, we've been very pro-industrial policy. Actually, we talked about it last season as well, too. So in the note of fairness, we wanted to bring on a fellow Hudson colleague who's been doing some really interesting work on America's industrial capacity, but who also wrote a op-ed in the Wall Street Journal last month that was actually anti-industrial policy. So helpfully for us in terms of this episode coming out this week, Helpfully for us, the debate around Buy American policies actually broke out in the White House. So before we dive into your op-ed, can you sort of give some context to how people are talking about Buy American policies in the context of COVID-19?
Well, I would note from the start that Buy American is not necessarily the unique thing that defines an industrial policy. An industrial policy can be much broader than that. So it's perfectly appropriate, I think, for governments, the United States, which is trying to do everything it can to reindustrialize. And I am not against reindustrialization. I've been writing about it for 25 or 30 years. It's the nuances with full-blown industrial policy that I take issue with. So in terms of Buy American, I'm all for it. You have to have some limits. We're a member of the World Trade Organization, and so are a lot of other nations, and it protects us by giving us access to markets in other countries in principle. It's the principle is not always followed. But so for starters, I'm not totally against things that will help America reindustrialize. In fact, I'm very much in favor of those. It's just the way you go about it that I sometimes have trouble with.
And before we dive into sort of the specific plans that different senators and different members of Congress proposed, can you just explain for the audience the difference between, like you're saying, reindustrializing and industrial policy? Because these terms are thrown around a lot. So I think it'd be helpful to sort of get that out on the table.
Okay. So what I think of industrial policy is a concerted effort from the top in a federal system like the United States or other democracies to give power of decision making to a narrow group of people in the government, oftentimes in partnerships with the private sector, but to pursue policies that support specific industries. And those people who, at the top, let's call them a technological elite or a governmental elite, have to make decisions about which industries they want to support. So we've had a plethora of ideas, especially since the pandemic began, for things like medical supplies, pharmaceuticals, personal protective equipment, the machine, ventilator machines, and the like. That's just one example, but most of the proponents of a full-blown industrial policy go way beyond that and look at the everything from the steel and aluminum industries to higher technology industries. So the distinction I would make is between across the board effort and empowerment of government officials in some coordination with the private sector to look at a whole array of industries for special support. And we can talk, if you want, in details about what those supports could be. I'm just a little bit skeptical of empowering too much technocratic elites. And I'm also worried about what that does to our ability to, number one, work with allies, and number two, have access to markets outside of the United States. In addition to my skepticism about whether or not it can really work, whether or not, you know, the historical examples that we could bring to the table really suggest that full-blown industrial policy can really work.
Mm-hmm. So, Tom, I mean, before we get into that, because I disagree with some of that, and I think we'll kick that around, is that I thought one of the more useful things that you laid out was actually the different types of prominent industrial policy in America. You laid out three specific ones. Could you go into that about what those three separate types of industrial policy look like? Because right now, in the context, you and I, we're talking about this in the day after Joe Biden releases like a $700 billion Buy American plan. And people are like, oh, look, Joe Biden is in favor of industrial policy. And they're comparing that with, you know, like proposals put together by Republican senators. Obviously, it's not necessarily exactly the same thing. And these things and definitions matter a lot. So in your estimation, what are kind of the three different types of prominent industrial
policy? And let's start with your example of Senator Chuck Schumer and Senator Todd Young, Democrat and Republican, obviously.
The industrial policy variety that they support is a mixed one. They propose something like $100 billion plus over 5 years. But they support not only things like medical products and defense-related products, but they want to empower and create a sub-part of the National Science Foundation and call it the Technology Directorate under the NSF. And if you look at the specifics of their proposal, they have 10 different industries that they would support. Now, those might be the 10 industries that are going to lead us to the industrial reindustrialization nirvana that we would all like to see in the United States, but they may be wrong too. So my objection to that is simply that it gets a little bit too specific and it puts too much power in a unelected bureaucracy. And we all always have to think about who is going to control that bureaucracy. And, you know, there's lots of economic research about mistakes that have been made over the course of time. But we also have to recognize that even in a democracy, there can be the capture of the bureaucratic elites by interested parties of one sort or another. So sure. It's those sorts of worries that lead me to be a little bit more skeptical than some on what I call a full-blown industrial policy.
So the next one is the one put forth by progressive Democrats, Senator Sherrod Brown, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and then Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. How would you define their plan and your opposition to it?
Well, they have no compunction at all about establishing a really broad range of industrial sectors that they would support. Senator Brown from Ohio, the great industrial state of Ohio, has long been in favor of creating jobs in what we might call the traditional industrial heartland of America, auto, steel, and the like. I'm a little bit skeptical of that because my sense is that that can be expanded to just about anything one wants. We have seen that even the Trump administration, the first move out of the box for them on trade policy was tariffs on steel and aluminum, and then on appliances. And that did a lot to alienate our traditional allies. So that's one objection I have to things like that.
And which allies?
Well, the Europeans, the Australians, the Japanese, the Koreans, to name a few. Now, my bigger objection to the Democratic proposals is that you always have to take into account that they have other agendas than just reindustrialization. They have an agenda, you mentioned AOC, for a Green New Deal. And what that means is that they would, I expect, continue on the quest to shut down the carbon economy in the United States, which has been one of the pillars of the industrial strength of the United States for a long time, especially in the last 10 years since we've had the shale gas revolution. So it's a trade-off, if you will. We're a democracy, we can make that trade-off. But every time there is a decision to be made about whether or not we want to continue in some form with a carbon-based economy, I fear that a Biden administration, pushed by the progressive forces in the Democratic Party, would push it just to simply make the decision in favor of green technologies versus carbon-based technologies. That will raise the price of energy in the United States. That will have a negative effect on overall industrial strength in the United States, because the industrial sector, after all, uses a third of all the energy used in the United States. I'm in favor of moving towards a less carbon-based economy, but natural gas is, as many have said, a good transition as we try to develop greener technologies. But I don't want to just shut down the oil and gas sector, the chemicals sector, which is absolutely booming in the United States because of the shale revolution. So those are some of my fears about progressive Democratic industrial policy.
And I think the final one is, this is kind of a newer strain, definitely one we've championed on this podcast, put forth by Senator Rubio and Josh Hawley, which is really trying to reverse industrial decline and to compete more with China. Just characterize that maybe a bit differently than the other two, and also, you know, lay out some of your objections to it, and then we'll get into it a little bit.
Okay, I'm generally sympathetic to what especially Senator Rubio is trying to do. And there are others. There are lots of think tank people you've probably had on your podcast. The American Compass people, the Information Technology Foundation, all have put forth fairly specific ideas that go to the same goal. And I, number one, agree with Senator Rubio and others that pure economic efficiency and pure laissez-faire economics should not be the basis of overall economic policy in the United States. It has led to the partial deindustrialization of America. So I also agree with the Rubio, Hawley, Senator Young as well, for that matter, who argue that we need to strengthen the core capabilities of the United States to be a competitive industrial power. I agree that we ought to fully embrace basic scientific research, and scientific research especially that goes into the industrial sector, technology of all sorts, but basic manufacturing as well. That has been the core goal and objective of the National Science Foundation since it was started in the 1940s, as Senator Young points out. So I'd go for a big increase in basic research, especially in the physical sciences, engineering, and technology. I would also agree with Senator Rubio and Senator Hawley that we should put a lot more money into the workforce that is required for reindustrialization. And that's both at the, for lack of a better term, the blue collar, the production level of workers, maybe less than college educated, but increasingly needing specific skills, reprogramming of computer controlled machines, for instance. Mm-hmm. But it also means putting more money and trying to develop more scientists and engineers, especially American scientists and engineers. So my objection, especially to Senator Rubio, is that he basically embraces the type of broad-based specific industrial policy that would, in my mind, go too far in empowering, as I said, government technocrats, and leave us open to political influence of what types of technologies we are supporting. And again, I just reiterate that there have been a lot of mistakes made in the past by other countries that have employed industrial policies, including the Chinese, the Japanese, the Europeans. Just think of the Concorde airplane, which was one of the first major efforts at creating a new industry, and it fell flat on its face. Hmm.
So, Tom, when I'm listening to all of this, a common objection seems to be kind of a quasi-libertarian, just like skepticism of government bureaucrats. And yet, I've never found it particularly convincing, the idea that, government bureaucracy can go bad means that we shouldn't have government bureaucracy at all to a specific political end. So, if we have, we have elections, right, every 4 years in this country, and we have a presidential administration which is able to come in and which is able to direct said industrial policy, what keeps it from being captured by this kind of technocratic, meritocratic elite? Because from where I'm sitting, the technocratic elite is already anti-industrial policy. They're kind of anti-manufacturing. I'll be inflammatory and say anti-American worker, because they're largely more interested in increasing shareholder value. So what is the real concern here? Because it's never been a convincing argument to me that just because a government policy went bad a couple of times, that we shouldn't have any policy whatsoever.
Well, to cut in though, that's not quite what Tom's saying. Sure, because I think, and I'll let you answer Sagar's question, just to put my sort of pitch on it, which is that we're not advocating for no policy here. Just the point is that the top-down desire, Tom, just to clarify, would you define your position as saying the government can't just say, hey, we're going to create a supersonic transport industry and then succeed? That seems to be the position that Tom is advocating for. He's not saying you can't have, you know, critical industries such as healthcare and national security that you can't identify as important, but there's a difference between doing that and saying we're just going to dominate with the Concorde in the 70s. Is that a correct interpretation, Tom?
Yeah, I think you're on the right track there. I mean, look, even in that op-ed that you guys cited earlier, I said, you know, defense-related technologies and medical supplies, one sort or another, you know, are pretty core to what we need to worry about. As for, you know, general skepticism of bureaucrats, you know, this is the 21st century. The U.S. government represents, what, 20% of GDP, state governments, you know, a bit more than that. We're pretty far down the road, and so I'm not arguing that for a pure libertarian approach on this. I'm just arguing for limits because I am skeptical that in the long run we can fine-tune the economy. Now, let me just offer one other critique of this, which is an industrial policy can be antithetical to reindustrialization. I mean, what we've got on the table from the progressive Democrats now is totally contradictory in my view. I mean, you have the green element that,
right?
You know, I'm not against green, but green uberalis I am against. And it's going to take a long time to get to where we need to be on energy balances. But if you look at the Biden plan, he's going to the tax part of the Biden plan, he claims that our tax policy leads to deindustrialization because we try to, the Trump administration tried to equalize the tax burden on corporations. Well, because our corporate taxes were so much higher than those in even Europe, Japan, let alone places like Ireland and Switzerland. So the Biden plan would reverse those tax incentives, which were, in my view, just to equalize the tax burden on U.S. industry. More than that, the Biden plan would raise corporate taxes. It would undermine the ability, the parts of the Trump tax plan that worked against double taxation. It also does not address border adjustable taxes, which the Europeans use to as a subsidy for their own industry. The Japanese do as well. So to me, those plans are inherently contradictory. And I think in the long run, the cumulative effect of privileging redistribution of wealth, a green economy, and taxing the rich would undermine the industrial sector in the United States as we know it now.
I think that's a really important point, is that these progressives are putting forward a quasi-industrial policy really in forward of a, I mean, I think you're right to say it, an anti-industrial view in favor of more of a future view. I guess the question that we're trying to settle is, I mean, one of the things we focus here a lot is about peer competition with China. And, you know, when you have a China Made in 2025 plan, when you have such directed state commerce enterprise and so much more that we see in terms of our competition, it just doesn't seem satisfactory, you know, just to focus just on defense and medical when 2025 on their part is so much more. I mean, we're talking about commercial airline industry. We're talking about, you know, their vitamin supply. We're talking about the very kind of sovereignty as a nation, which expands just much more out of kind of the critical sectors that you lay out there in the piece.
So I'm just going to cut in real quick because I think there's an interesting disagreement between the two of you that there's some nuance to. Sagar, could you tell Tom what is a specific thing you want the government to do, right? So like we're talking about the idea of reindustrialization. We've both said this, right? So there's no disagreement on that, but what is something you want? So do you want the government to invest in Airbus, not Airbus, but like Boeing? Like what is it that you want? I want to know what Tom thinks about that specific ask of government.
Yeah, I mean, I do want the government to invest more in Boeing, and I want them to tell them, don't buy back $40 billion worth of your stock. I want you to build X airplane and do it well and be a good company. And given the amount of government contracts that we give Boeing, it doesn't seem like a particularly controversial ask.
What are some examples?
I mean, Tom laid out, I think, the steel industry, right? Like, I think a critical, robust, and thriving steel industry means I don't think you can be a sovereign nation without a steel industry like that. And, you know, I think allies are great, but I think that being able to make steel is better. And that at the end of the day, our allyship is only really built upon our superpower projection that we can only have with a real defense base. So those are like two specific ideas that I would love to hear your thoughts on, Tom.
Okay, on commercial aviation, I would just note the Chinese have been trying for a long time. They put a lot of money, as you noted, into their commercial aviation industry, and they have zero planes that are commercially competitive and can even be licensed to fly by the safety authorities. So to me, that's a failure of their industrial policy. But that's not your point. The semiconductor industry is, to me, a very interesting one because the Chinese have made some progress there. I think they're still behind us. So my view is that we do more to support the infrastructure, including the intellectual infrastructure, that allows us to keep a lead in high technology products like semiconductors. So, you know, National Science Foundation research, tax incentives. I'm in favor of expensing of capital equipment and stuff like that, which makes it easier to invest in the United States. Equalization of tax rates. I mean, we at least need to be competitive with lots of places on taxation. So I'm all for what Rubio and Holly have proposed in terms of building up the American abilities to have robust industries. But I'm also, I think I've been pretty hawkish on China for a long time. I wrote articles in the Wall Street Journal arguing against having China in the World Trade Organization. I'm very much in favor of using every tool we have at our disposal, including unilateral tools, to deny access of subsidized Chinese industries that they've stolen intellectual property. So fight back aggressively on the trade front as well. Mm-hmm. I wish we could get our allies to help us there. Maybe this, you know, latest series of events where China has not been forthcoming on the pandemic virus. They've used the crisis in the world to punish Hong Kong. They've got their eyes on Taiwan now. They want to continue to their ethnic cultural cleansing in the far west of China. I'm for all kinds of ways of fighting back against the Chinese. I just don't think that we need to have specific, very specific goals for American companies and order our companies what to do. And Sagar, you mentioned the whole questions about finance capital, which we probably don't have time to get into. I'm somewhat sympathetic about looking at some of the things that you talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think to finish up, this has been really great. Just to build up on the China point, I think the reason why this debate matters and why I think it's really broken out into the open is that it's always seen in the context of the Chinese manufacturing threat. And I think Sagar's referenced the Made in 2025 plan. And what's unique about that, as you know, is that that's not simply about competing with the US when it comes to sort of 1980s, low quality sneakers, sort of things like that. It's about what are the next generation products that are going to sort of look like. So could you just sort of, to lead us out of the show, like, what do you think the current threat from China is when it comes to these next generation technologies?
Well, I guess we would have to get fairly specific. I'm skeptical about Chinese and commercial aviation. I don't think they're anywhere near where we need to be. Clearly on 5G telecommunications technology, they are a competitor. I think there's certain things that certain technology, newer technologies such as virtual networks, where we have a lead. We need to support efforts perfect those newer technologies. We also need to keep Huawei out of as many countries as we can and deny them the economies of scale that they need. On semiconductors, I do support a more robust investment climate. I support more federal research on the underlying technologies. I'm not quite there yet on subsidizing the building of new fabrication plants in the United States. I think we need to do everything we can to have an environment which is favorable towards those investments. And I do think we need to use trade tools, investment screening tools to keep the Chinese out of as many markets as we can where they're subsidizing. And I'm also in favor of, and I both Rubio and Hawley, Young's bill, all mention cooperative efforts with allies. Now, if we're going to cooperate with allies, you know, it takes two to tango. I am concerned with the Europeans, especially because since the Trump administration got tough on China, since the pandemic, there's been an inward turn, I think, in Europe especially. And another objection I have to aggressive an industrial policy is that I think we get into a competition not only with China, but also with Europe, Japan, Korea. And I don't want to empower them to get into a race with us to see who can subsidize the cloud industry or semiconductor industry more. I'd rather see cooperative efforts if we could get them. I mean, I'm not underestimating the difficulty of convincing the Europeans, especially, to work with us. But hopefully those are some specifics that point out, some of my differences with the more hardcore industrial policy advocates.
Mm. No, I think this has been very useful kind of for laying the groundwork, because it's a term that doesn't necessarily, I mean, it's thrown around a lot, and, definitely so on this podcast, but the definitions that you offered and kind of the specific disagreements, I think, are very valuable for anybody who's really thinking through this. So, Tom, we really appreciate you joining the podcast. Thank you so much for your analysis here.
Thank you, guys. Enjoyed the back and forth with you guys.
Yeah, it was great.
Thanks.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. As always, please share the podcast with your friends. And if you didn't get the chance, we'd appreciate you scrolling to the bottom of the podcast page and rating us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. We'd also appreciate a written review of how much you enjoy the podcast.
All right, we're going to see you guys next week. It is the season finale here at The Realignment, and we are going to have FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr. Brendan's been making big waves on Capitol Hill in Washington and in Silicon Valley. He's an excellent guest in order to wrap up all the interesting things that we covered this season. We got China, big tech, and so much more. I'm really, really excited for it, and we will see you guys next week.